Hi, everyone. My name is Ximena Bustillo. I'm a politics reporter over at NPR based out of New York and D.C. I'm really excited to be here for this panel. My start as a political journalist started in May of 2020, covering food and agriculture. And for anyone that might not remember, May of 2020 was a really hectic time. And so many things happened on Capitol Hill at that time, particularly revolving around money and spending. And I really cut my teeth as a political journalist following how there were all these bills and all these packages that lawmakers wanted to pass related to the pandemic in some instances that they wanted to attach other provisions to. And then it molded into infrastructure and in, you know, looking at climate packages and healthcare and all these other things. But over the course of 2 years, as I've heard many of you talk about in this conference today, we ended up with record spending in terms of climate change and energy policy, even dating as far back as ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act, which had nothing to do with infrastructure or climate. It was a COVID relief bill. Yet that's where a lot of this spending started and kicked off really by the Biden administration, and he ran on climate. I've talked to countless of young voters who say that that's one of the reasons they turned out to vote for him in 2020 amid literally everything else. Now we're looking at 2024, and I feel like everyone has avoided talking about the election this whole conference when we look at how we are looking ahead at what this money is going to be doing, what the implications are, and the implications of what if there's an administration change. You know, I would really turn to the earlier discussion this morning with Secretary Regan as kind of that setting ground of what are the implications, what can be lost, and what can be changed just by one person in one office changing. But it's not just about one person in one office. There are countless other elections that really matter, city council elections, state legislature seats, mayor's races, governor races, that really do flip control not just only of party politics, but can change methodologies and how money is spent, what programs are enacted. And so that's really what I hope we kind of get to today, is looking at how all those changes really matter. As just some ground setting, I didn't invite any pollsters up to this panel, so I will just, you know, give a few statistics generally. The latest Harvard Youth and also Tufts Circle poll finds that young voters particularly really do care about climate. Even young Republicans and Democrats, young Democrats do tend to rank it higher, but young Republicans increasingly want to see their elected officials discuss the topic and have challenged even some of the recent political candidates running for the top GOP seat on the issue. It's important to remember that this year, Gen Z and millennial voters will make up 48% of all eligible voters. And so if not now, we're always looking at the next election, right? So 2026 and 2028 already around the corner, you guys. And Gen Z voters will be an even bigger part of that electorate, which means that conversations we're having now will trickle up into those other years that I know we're already so excited to talk about. But it's not just about the voters. It's about how we are discussing this topic. There are groups such as Third Way, which is, you know, a center-left group that say Democrats do need to pivot back, you know, not just talk about climate, but focus back on the pocketbook issues. It's the economy, stupid, right, that we really, really care about, looking at utility costs and other ways to connect with voters on the issues that they are really currently right now angry about and mobilized about. Conservatives feel that way too. They want to see their leaders talk about national security and other ways that energy can be used in conservative spaces, as opposed to just as a climate point for climate as the end goal. I'm sure many progressive groups want to see more climate as the end goal. So a lot to unpack here today. We're going to be discussing voters, who voters are, where voters that care about climate can be found and where we can really focus on them as a voting block. We're going to be talking about the issues, how climate as a voting issue is playing out right now in the election, and then ultimately the implications, right, not just after November, but also for us as journalists and an industry. And I know that the second plenary will get into that even deeper, so hopefully we can set that up a little bit. But first, kick it off to my amazing people here. Carly, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, then everyone say your name and a little bit about the work that you do.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Jimena, for that amazing introduction. Hi, everyone. I'm Carly Matthews. I'm the Vice President of Communications at the American Conservation Coalition. We are the largest conservative environmental group in the country. We have about 40,000 members, about 18 to 35 age range, all over the country in about 100 branches, either on college campuses like this one or in young professional communities. And we even have some high school branches, so we're starting them very young. And really our goal here is to build the conservative environmental movement and show that this next generation of conservatives wants real engagement from their leaders on the issues of environmental stewardship, energy, and climate. So I'm really excited to be here today. I went to school just up the road at Temple University, so it's nice to come home and be in Philadelphia for a weekend.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Stinnett from the Environmental Voter Project. And I also am having like a little homecoming. I grew up about 10 minutes from here, and both of my parents worked at Penn, so this is really exciting. The Environmental Voter Project is a nonpartisan nonprofit that is laser focused on finding people who care deeply about climate and the environment yet don't vote, and turning them into better voters. That's it. We find environmentalists who don't vote, and we turn them into better voters. And so what that looks like is a lot of data science to figure out who these individuals are, and then a lot of year-round campaigning and use of behavioral science and messaging that is targeted, again, to just do one thing, not convince people to care more about climate, but to convince the ones who already care to get out and vote.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Friday. I am Brittany Bell Surratt, Senior Director of Storytelling and Communications at the Hip Hop Caucus. I don't have the Philly home connection. I am originally from Natchez, Mississippi, but I've been in D.C. for 20-plus years. And at Hip Hop Caucus, we are a nonpartisan nonprofit that is national, and we have four main pillars of work. That is our environmental justice, our economic justice, our voter and civic engagement, and then our control department, which is about civil and human rights. And so particularly for all of those pillars, we have a focus on mobilizing BIPOC voters, but particularly with the capital B Black voters, and our issues are specifically catered to talking to those that constituency.
Excellent. Great. Thank you so much for having us here. I'm Wendy Wendland, President of Environment America. We work for clean air, clean water, and open spaces. Our bread and butter is state-level advocacy in 30 states. Many of you might know our state affiliate in Environment California or Environment Oregon or Environment Massachusetts, working all over the country. We are 100% focused on environmental advocacy. We are not we don't consider ourselves a progressive group or an arm of the Democratic Party. We're just first and foremost focused on solving environmental problems. I have no connection to Philadelphia either, other than coming to visit a few times. I'm from Oregon originally, was the state director of WashPerg in Seattle for many years, and I live in Los Angeles. So I have a very West Coast-centered view of the world.
Amazing. Thank you, everyone, of course, for making the journey home or visiting a new location. All people welcome here. I want to first open up with Nathaniel. You know, when thinking about voters, right, there are the environmental first voters, but we know most people aren't that. So who are these voters generally, and what are their differences?
Yeah, so there are a million ways to define climate voters. So let me first just let you know what definition I'm going to use here. Because we at the Environmental Voter Project are so focused on turnout, and we don't want to spend any time changing people's opinions or changing people's minds, we have a very high bar for what it means to be a climate voter. We're focused on people who are very likely to list either climate or some other environmental issue as their number one priority over all other issues. Okay, if that's how we define climate voters, these people are disproportionately young, although there's some nuance there. It's not as simple as the older you get, the less likely you are to care about climate. It's actually more like a U, where we have a whole bunch of young people, and then it's middle-aged folks. There are very few of them who list climate as a top priority, and then it starts going up again, especially among older women. Second big demographic trend that we consistently see is the climate movement is disproportionately people of color in pretty significant ways, especially Black, AAPI, and Native American voters. There's a lot of difference from state to state, but that's the second big trend that we see. And then the third thing is they're disproportionately lower income. So disproportionately young, disproportionately people of color, disproportionately lower income.
And you know, Brittany, you're doing a lot of work in swing states. Pennsylvania is a swing state. We have Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, also a lot of states that are either in the middle of an energy transition or are seeing really intense impacts of climate. You know, can you talk a little bit about some of the work you're doing in targeting and educating voters here?
Yeah, sure. So a major campaign that we have is our Respect My Vote campaign. And what we do with Respect My Vote is that we try to mobilize folks to, one, learn about all of the different elections that are important to you, local, state, and then federal elections, and then activate people with a climate lens, right? So for us, climate is intersectional for all of the things that you may care about, that you may not necessarily know this is why this is important or how this is affecting. So we have a campaigns and advocacy arm. We are in D.C., have an office in D.C. in which we have our policy folks who are on the Hill and talking to our congressional people, but then we also have our advocacy arm where we're on the ground. We are mobilizing with grassroots organizations on the ground. We're at local town halls talking to folks in Louisiana. We are with residents in their schools, and that's how we do what we say from the streets to the suites is kind of how we describe the work that we do to make sure that we are touching folks at all different levels to get them engaged in voting, but also to get them educated on different issues.
Just one follow-up for you. I don't want to kid anyone here. The election's at this point not going to be swung on climate. I mean, never say never, anything can happen in 6 months. But right now, abortion, democracy, economy, right, so many other things are front of mind for voters. So what is that importance to you of going to that local level? Do you feel like it's more salient at the local level when talking about city council races versus the presidency?
I think at the local level, it makes things more relevant for you. If you are having issues with your sewage or your electricity bill that's going up as a result of what's happening in the climate, it's getting hotter, then that is, you're going to talk to your public utilities person, right? If there are jobs that are coming as we do this green job transition and there is money that's coming into your local area, then you want to talk to your council people, you want to talk to your mayor about those different, you want to talk to the representative of your area so that you can know how, as maybe a business person, to capitalize off that money that's coming. Or maybe you want to talk to make sure that in your community, as these transitions are happening and these jobs are coming, that X percent of the folks who live there are being hired.
Mm-hmm. And Wendy, you know, kind of looking at your work, where do you see climate as being salient or not?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more where you just stated things are. I mean, do I wish that climate or clean air, clean water, open spaces, any one of them was, you know, a third rail issue like Medicare or Social Security? Of course, absolutely. But we're not there, and we're not going to be there before this election for sure. I don't think that means that we can't talk about things that are related to climate, and I think there's great opportunity. Every candidate has to figure out the voter combination, you know, the always voters and the occasional voters and the young voters and the swing voters, and, you know, what's the combination of votes that they need, whether they're running for city council or they're running for president. So every candidate has to think about that, and they then have to be careful about the messaging between those different buckets of voters. And so, you know, a candidate that may think, well, I have to appeal to those young voters who are really fired up about climate and talk about the climate emergency, well, they have to be careful in saying that they don't actually push away the independent or swing voter that they need to win the election. So I think there's a real opportunity, though, around a set of issues that this, particularly at the federal level, there's so much that has been done that a broad majority of people support. So, you know, incentives for renewable energy and tax credits for electric vehicles, and we'll get to it probably later, but hundreds of things, and those of you that attended the session on the Inflation Reduction Act will know, there are so many things happening that are supported by a broad majority of people.
Mm-hmm. And for Carly, kind of looking at you, we always talk about young people. They're a growing demographic, and they're different in that a lot of Gen Z voters are starting to refuse affiliating specifically with the party, but they do really care about issues. You know, how are young conservatives, you know, feeling about that trajectory at a time when there still is a stigma on Republican lawmakers and their approach to climate?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think perhaps some of you in the audience covered the first Republican debate in August when a young member of ACC actually asked the question about climate change and whether or not Republican candidates for the highest office in our country were going to address the issue of climate and kind of calm the concerns that Republicans don't care about the issue at all. So I think that that's really indicative of where young conservatives are on this, and what I'll add to that is I think it's hard to say that climate would be the number one issue for young conservatives. I think you'd be really hard-pressed to find data that backed that up. But climate denial is an automatic turnoff for young conservatives. And we saw this really clearly this winter when we did kind of listening sessions with all of the Republican primary candidates, and we got a lot of backlash for hosting Vivek because of his comments on climate. And I think it ended up being a really interesting and educational conversation in which our president kind of pushed him and said, you know, this approach to this issue, this outright denial that we need a strategy on climate, it's not going to work with young voters. And I think we all saw how that worked out for him. So
another one bit the dust. So I guess kind of thinking about that, you know, what are the issues? When thinking about climate change as a voting issue, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, what we see back here, just climate, yes, no, like, what do we see as interests from voters?
Yeah, so I think probably the clearest way to think about it, and certainly the way many journalists are going to have this issue presented to them, is that, as Wendy alluded to, there are different groups of people who will decide who wins and lose various elections, and candidates provide different types of messaging to those people for different purposes. And I think this is so important because I think most of us have this image in our minds that every big national election is decided by trying to change the minds of a few undecided people who might also be moderates. And that's just not the case. It's just not the case. And so I'll quickly try to walk you through it. Maybe you have heard Joe Biden say something like, when I think about climate change, I think about jobs, or I think about people in hard hats, you know, like Joe from Scranton. That is essentially defensive messaging, right? It's him trying to say, you know what, blue-collar workers, when you hear me talk about climate, it's all right, I'm not scary, because I'm thinking about more jobs for you. That's to a specific group of people with a specific goal in mind. Now, there are going to be other people, maybe some folks who are like a little bit curious about RFK Jr. or stuff like that, where Joe Biden is going to be trying to persuade them that he is a good climate leader. Very different group of people, very different purpose, very different message. And then the third group and message is going to be there are a whole bunch of people who care deeply about climate change already. They're not scared of any messaging on it, nor do they need to be persuaded that the policies are good or bad. They need to be persuaded to get off the couch and go to the polls on election day. And chances are, any of the messaging that you hear is going to fit into one of those three buckets, and it's really important to see it in that way. And I think that's how climate is going to impact this election the most. Are we talking to people who need to be persuaded, who need to be defended against, or need to get off the couch and go to the polls?
And there are kind of like these little nuggets, right? Like jobs, economy, like that are dropped. But, you know, I'd love to hear from Brittany and Wendy, like what is resonating with voters on the ground? And Carly as well, if you want to speak to especially like young voters, like when they say climate, what do they mean?
Well, I'll start with what's resonating on the ground, particularly in communities that we are in. And it is less about hard-hit jobs when we talk about economics and the economy, and more about how is this affecting my pocketbook right in this moment, right? So we try to make it plain. If it's hotter and your, like I stated earlier, electricity bill is going up, that's an issue. If there is a petrochemical facility that is built, you know, 10 feet away from your home, and now your kid has asthma, and your mom, your grandma in their 40s and 70s, they have cancer. Now we have a health issue. Not only because of this asthma is, do I have to take my kid out of school more and take them to the hospital, to the doctor more? This is now an educational issue. This is impacting how they're learning. If I have to, you know, go see the doctor for my aunt and my grandma, then it's likely that my health insurance costs are going up, right? If I am near this petrochemical facility or if my house is in a flood zone, we know that black folks in their houses are already under appraised. Now we have a under appraisal because we're in this flood zone, and the equity that I could get out of my home to send my kids to college, I'm not able to maximize. So now I'm taking a loan out with higher interest rates. Like, it's one thing after another. And so when we come to communities and we talk about how climate is an issue that is intersectional and affects you right now, those are the things that we're saying. We steer a little bit less away from, you know, emissions and all of the real science talk, and we get straight to like what's happening with you right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we tend to really hone in on public health because we find that that is something that resonates with kind of all of the buckets of voters. And maybe a good example to use is soot. And I'll use the contrast between Trump and Biden because one of the things that polling is showing is that most voters don't remember the Trump years. I know for some of us in this room, we remember them well. But for a lot of people, they really don't remember, and they certainly are not remembering the hundreds of environmental regulations that Trump rolled back. So you have a contrast there, and they don't really know what Biden has done. So I think figuring out how to provide issues that resonate with people and then providing the contrast, so soot is a good example. So during the Trump administration, there was a lot, there were additional studies coming out about how terrible soot is, how terrible it is for public health, for, you know, premature deaths and asthma symptoms, and Trump refused to tighten the regulation. The Biden administration in February passed a rule which will prevent 4,500 premature deaths and prevent 800,000 people from having symptoms from asthma related to soot pollution. I think the more we can provide that kind of information for people, the more they can grasp the difference between the candidates. And again, we know that, you know, reducing our use of dirty fossil fuel power plants is what will help us with climate change. But it's just as easy to talk about clean air and the importance of that and getting people on board with, you know, the difference between the candidates on that.
Yeah, and if I could tie a bow on that, kind of pulling from what Brittany was saying about kind of avoiding the science-y talk, I think that's really important for young people. And in polling that we've done, and even anecdotally on the ground, young people don't necessarily make a huge difference between general conservation and climate and energy. It's all the environment, and they care about it. So I think that that's a big kind of driving force in communications about like clean air, clean water, a healthy environment to call home. It doesn't have to be parts per million or emissions. It can really be like protecting your backyard.
Mm-hmm. And how, just real quick before you put that down, how do you, you know, when you talk to young folks in high schools and in college campuses, when they say climate, I mean, like, what does that mean to them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it depends a little bit on if they're in high school, if they're in college, if they're working. But I think it just means to them it's getting warmer. They're seeing changes in their community. They're concerned perhaps even about like wildlife or changes they're seeing there. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, thinking about how much carbon is in the atmosphere. I think it's more about kind of things that they can see, maybe more hurricanes, maybe, you know, summers being really hot. I live in Washington, D.C. The cherry blossoms were like a week and a half early. So I think it's little things like that that people notice.
Can I add something about young voters? Because we work a lot with the student PIRGs, the public interest research groups, which probably many of you have followed. And I'm always struck by the image that most gets reported is the angry mob of students calling for a climate emergency. And, you know, that's, they're speaking for every young person in America. And my own experience of it is that young people, it's more like exactly what Carly said. They just want to make a difference on these issues. And they're actually more likely to join a group that's working to get the University of California system to go 100% renewable, or to get their campus to stop using fossil fuel-based styrofoam. They want to do something where they can have an impact. So one suggestion I have for those of you in the room is to lift up those voices, in part because it will help the candidates see that those are young people who care about these issues, who are doing the work and are likely to vote because they are kind of paying attention more than most. And so the more stories there are about those kinds of students doing that local, mostly local action, I think can really make a difference.
We have been talking a lot, like in the politics space, about how this election is really going to come down to turnout, which, you know, all elections do, right? When you really think about it, people have to turn out, they have to vote. You know, in some areas, that can really make the difference. Looking at swing states like Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, you know, where does climate play a role in whether or not people get off the couch, as you said earlier?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I'll just start throwing some numbers out at you. So in Georgia was decided by 11,799 votes 4 years ago. At the Environmental Voter Project, we've identified 491,000 already registered voters who care deeply about climate and the environment, who have never voted before. Arizona was decided by about 12,000 votes. We've identified 240,000 registered voters who are super environmentalists who have never voted before. And if these numbers sound huge to you, first of all, they are, but let me give you some context. We have about 260 million adults in the United States. 240 million are eligible to vote, because not all adults are eligible to vote. About 220 million are registered to vote. 4 years ago, we had the highest turnout presidential election ever, and out of those 220 million registered voters, 160 million voted in the highest presidential turnout election ever. So think about that huge chasm of 60 million registered voters who don't show up, 80 million eligible voters who don't show up, and understands that when we're talking about people who care deeply about climate, disproportionately young, disproportionately people of color, disproportionately lower income, they're much more likely to be in that group of non-voters. And so as you think about where climate can make a difference, especially in the context of voter turnout, you know, look at polling data and consider, like, what is the denominator here? Is it a poll of likely voters? Well, that makes sense. Politicians don't care about unlikely voters, but maybe, just maybe, all of the climate and environmental folks are in that unlikely pot. And so, yeah, turnout is going to be everything for the climate movement.
The other factor with this election, and I'll turn to Brittany in a second here to talk about what she's hearing on the ground, is a lot of disillusionment from voters. So many people tell me they didn't want another Biden versus Trump. A lot of people didn't even want Trump number three. Like, it is just the same. And if you aren't mobilized by other local initiatives, such as abortion initiative on the ballot in your state, a really heated governor's race, like maybe we're seeing in North Carolina, like if you're not motivated by anything else, you know, you do turn to those issues. And, you know, my question for Brittany is, you know, the Biden administration is really going hard on, and the Biden campaign, I should say, the Biden campaign, sorry, asterisk for any admin official in here, is really going hard on infrastructure, you know, all the spending that's going out there, rural areas, red areas, like record money. But no one knows what it is. You know, when talking with people on the ground, how is that process of getting people to connect the dots and mobilizing them in any way to just kind of see that trickle up?
I want to address two things really quickly. I think that I'd be remiss to name the voter suppression tactics that happen to keep particularly Black folks from coming to the polls. So in addition to whatever disillusionment you may feel, then you also have, you know, these obstacles that are purposely put in a way to keep you from voting. When it comes to your question, I think the Biden campaign has a lot of work to do with their on-the-ground local game, right? At some point, we've gotten away from folks kind of being in communities, going door-to-door, talking about, you know, what the issues are and what's out there. I think for particularly anything with IRA, to do that, that is going to be key. I also think that the removal or what's happening around DEI is going to continue to be a roadblock for that, you know, money and that agenda to move forward. So particularly in communities of color, I think that states have to figure that out if they want to figure it out, right? It's not without intention that this DEI thing is so big and is becoming so popularized, and the trickle effect that it has on policy that the campaign may be trying to push. What, Minister?
And those things are always most salient at the local level. And I think that's something, Wendy, you and I talk about all the time, too, is all politics is local, right? So when looking at those levels, that connecting of dots, you know, what is the work that needs to be done from campaigns, but also, like, just to reach voters?
Well, I was thinking about what the work could be done from this as crowd that's assembled.
Because maybe that, too.
Honestly, I mean, the Biden administration, you know, they managed to pass the Inflation Reduction Act, which is $369 billion for climate programs. That's billion with a B. And again, many of you probably heard the session this morning, so you know a little bit more about it or have already been covering it. All of that money is heading out, and it is going to land in communities. I mean, there is something for every voter, every community in that legislation. But there needs to be more stories written about the things that affect a particular community. Because I do think that Tip O'Neill, you know, all politics is local, is so true. People want to know, you know, what have you done for me? And again, in the legislation, there's something for everybody. I mean, lots of stories have been written, and I love this, about solar incentives and electric vehicle incentives and more battery charging stations, and all of that is great. But there are dozens, hundreds, I don't know exactly how many provisions, but when you look at any fact sheet about the Inflation Reduction Act, I think there's a story for you in there. And I urge you to find it and to tell it for the, you know, whether it's the state or a local community, and that can affect the local elections, or it can affect the statewide, or, you know, there's a lot of, governor's races and state legislatures in play as well. So, but really telling those stories, and we need help. I mean, the environmental community is at work, and if you visit any of our websites, if you go to ours, you'll definitely see stories about we've focused in on houses of worship. So we're working to spread the good word that you can, you know, put solar on your church and you can get incentives from the federal government to do that out of the Inflation Reduction Act. And that's like an awesome way to tell the story, because then people who attend that house of worship see, oh, I got something out of this. But there's so many stories to tell, and again, I'm mostly making a plea for all of you to help us tell those stories, because if I know a lot of you care as much as we do about solving the problem of climate change, and I just tell you, talking about climate change is not helping us. I mean, because it's become so polarized, it's kind of seen as a, you know, just one more progressive issue, and if we're going to win, we need to get more people on board. So I ask for your help.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on kind of the disillusionment piece just a little bit. We did some polling, but also just kind of like going to our members on the ground, hearing from branches. Only 39% of young rural conservatives thought their elected officials would be willing to listen to them at all on energy and the environment, which is a pretty dismal number for folks who, you know, should be going to the polls, should be communicating with their elected officials. So I think this disconnect between what people on the ground are thinking about the issue and what they think their voice can do on the federal level is really stark, and that's why ACC puts such an emphasis on local action and going out and cleaning up a community park, planting trees, partnering with a local organization to do an environmental initiative. So I think really empowering people on the ground can make them kind of more willing to lend their voice on the federal level. And that's something that we found to be true.
Yeah, I think it's important to just provide some context to something that I think everybody has touched on, and that is that, like, the Inflation Reduction Act is really popular and nobody knows about it. Mm-hmm. Because that's true. Pew Research does a lot of great polling on this, and Yale Program on Climate Change Communications does a lot of great polling on this. The most recent YPCCC poll said that 6 out of 10 registered voters either knew nothing, like literally zero, about the Inflation Reduction Act, or had only heard a little bit of it. And that's out of registered voters. So in theory, they're more politically engaged than, say, all adults or all eligible voters. Okay. After they got that information, they gave a little bit of blurb, like a little bit of information about the Inflation Reduction Act to the people on the poll. 7 out of 10 said, oh yeah, I'd support that. That's awesome. That's this huge disconnect here. And not that it's anybody's job to try to promote a certain like law or piece of legislation, but like, this is, by any objective measure, the largest climate law in United States history, and nobody knows about it. And that's a big problem right now.
I had I asked someone a question about the IRA once, and they're like, the NRA? And I was like, nope, retreat. So they're like, even just the acronym, like, people don't get it. Like, the government really is an alphabet soup situation out here. You know, kind of looking forward at these implications, you know, I am kind of curious, and Nathaniel, we'll go to you real quick. You know, how should we be thinking about climate, energy, you know, these voters that may or may not be engaged, you know, at different levels of the ballot?
Yeah, so I think that, as Brittany and Wendy have mentioned, there is almost always something much more compelling about bringing this huge collection of climate and environmental issues and making it local and real to people's everyday lived lives. On the other hand, I think we need to recognize that exactly 7 months from today, most people aren't going to go to the polls because they're really excited about their city council race. The presidential election is going to be driving a lot of this turnout. So for my money, one of the big things to keep in mind as far as how climate is going to impact things up and down the ballot is, again, when you look at the top line data of this poll, of these polls, as you and Wendy mentioned, far too few people list climate as a top priority. I don't think anybody can argue that. However, when you look at the crosstabs, so the subgroup data in the polls, usually anywhere from 4 to 9% of respondents say that climate's their number one priority. But when you look at that subgroup data, they're all potential Biden voters. It isn't like people who say climate's my number one priority and boy, do I love Donald Trump. Like, there aren't that many people like that. And so what that means is, You could have anywhere from 8 to 18% of Joe Biden's potential base listing climate as their number one priority. Again, I don't want to oversell this. I agree with Wendy that climate is not going to be the deciding issue of this election. However, I think it's also safe to say that if climate voters don't show up big time, he's toast.
And that's been a really big cross conversation for young voters, right? There are so many issues right now that young voters are feeling really passionate about, you know, specifically looking at the conflict between Israel and Gaza. You know, that is something that, you know, young Democrats are voicing a lot of opposition. And then you add on top of that disappointment in how Biden is handling climate. You know, that's at least two reasons to maybe stay home. But when faced with the other option, you know, people might be likely to toe the party line, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're all children of the Enlightenment, and we like to think that everybody is always a rational actor, and they're deciding whether to vote or not and making a cost-benefit analysis. But there are so many social factors at play. And yeah, if your peer group is really angry at American foreign policy, or they're feeling really disengaged or something like that, that's often much more likely to determine whether they walk out of their house on election day than whether they think their one vote can have an impact on climate policy because of who wins or loses an election. These social factors are really important.
A few more questions, and then I will turn it to audience questions so you guys can start migrating if you would like. But for Brittany, you know, kind of looking at the Hip Hop Caucus's, you know, history in this space, you know, it's not new at all. How have you seen the climate conversation? You know, we've gone back and forth, I feel like. Does it matter? Does it doesn't? You know, but we're talking about it. It is clearly a topic of conversation in debates and at conferences. You know, how have you seen that evolve over time?
Yeah, Hip Hop Caucus has been in the climate and environmental justice space since 2005 with Hurricane Katrina. We were incorporated as an organization in 2004, and voting and civic engagement is our foundation. In that 19 years, we, to your point, are seeing climate become a main stage topic. And so with that, it's being covered more in the media. With that, it is becoming more of an issue for, you know, it's always, not to say always, but there it's not unusual for third-party candidates to have climate as an issue over the last couple of elections. But now we're seeing the more, you know, your main party candidates see it as something as well. So I would say that, and then also how climate is not necessarily just a, you know, white-led movement, right? To Nathaniel's point, there are a lot of folks who were climate for BIPOC people. It is an issue, and they do care about it. Before, I would say maybe the last 4 or 5 years, those voices were pretty much unheard, and not because they didn't exist. We've been existing for 20 years almost, but it's because it doesn't fit necessarily the narrative of who should be talking about this. Right, our president and CEO, Reb Yearwood, was a Time 100 person. He was just, you know, honored for his work in environmental by the DC Environmental Film Festival. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, but when it comes to who's going to talk about it, he's not necessarily your go-to. We're not necessarily your go-to because we don't fit the narrative in our, the people who we represent are not necessarily the voices that folks want to uplift. And we're seeing some progress on that.
And Wendy, you know, the Environment America's Political Action Committee arm, right, and endorses Republicans and Democrats, assists in those campaigns. You know, how have you seen the issue of climate or energy evolve on that side?
Right. I mean, and we first canvassed on climate issues in 1990, wow. Right after that first, you know, 1980, or well, not the first, but one of the early 1989 studies. So we've been thinking about this issue for a long time. Yeah, so we do endorse both and make contributions both sides of the aisle. And I'd say a couple of things. One is, I said this earlier, but I think it bears repeating, that I think, unfortunately, climate, you know, per se, has kind of become this polarized issue and seen more as a progressive issue, which is a problem for us just in winning on climate in the long term, because we have to win a majority of the country. We have to win the hearts and minds of the American people, Republicans and Democrats. And so the more polarized it has become, and it sort of gets used as a weapon along with some of the other issues, I think that actually hurts our cause, the climate, you know, solving the climate crisis cause. So that's one thing I'd say. On the issue of energy, I think there's great stuff happening on both sides of the aisle that clean energy, because it has been seen as, you know, an economic issue as much as an environmental issue, that there's a lot of Republicans who love clean energy and work on it. And so I think it actually, clean energy works better for getting some of those middle swing voters on board with us. And again, in my continued plea on ideas for you, I mean, there was the great story done by Politico about John Curtis, who's a Republican who has really pushed back against who you guys probably work a lot with. You know, he's really pushed back against climate denialism. He's really worked to kind of bring Republicans along on climate. I don't agree with him on everything, but those kinds of stories are really helpful for, again, swing voters feeling comfortable, feeling like there is a home for them on these issues, that we want them to help us solve these problems.
And Carly, kind of same question to you. You know, ACC, arguably a little younger, literally and, you know, base-wise, but how have you seen just over the last few elections the topic evolve and become present, less present?
Yeah, so a little younger might be generous. We were founded about 6 years ago, so newer to this movement. But even since then, to Wendy's point, John Curtis and other leaders have been really instrumental in engaging on this issue from a conservative perspective and showing that conservative leadership on clean energy, on climate, is not only possible, but it's really kind of what conservatism is. If conserve and conservatism are not related, like, what do words mean? So I think that's been a really kind of promising movement. And then to the point about kind of bipartisanship, we had a round table in Los Angeles at the end of February with young advocates on both the left and the right, and we talked about nuclear energy, permitting reform, and environmental justice, and we couldn't get them to stop talking. Like, there was so much enthusiasm for finding common ground. So I think my point there is that younger generations, you brought this up earlier, are less tied to these political labels and more passionate about issues, and they're willing to work across divisions, across the aisle. And that's been really encouraging for me. I think that's been a big part of ACC's work, as being kind of that bridge builder in addition to building a like bona fide conservative movement.
And I know, Nathaniel, you used to work in like local political campaigns. You know, how have you seen that evolve from when you were doing that work to maybe candidates that might be more successful now on climate?
Yeah, so I come to this from the political world, not the climate and environmental world. And I started the Environmental Voter Project because I was so frustrated. In all of the campaigns I worked in, we would poll likely voters, and like 1% would list climate as a top priority, 2%. The very last campaign that I ran was a mayoral campaign in Boston. And, you know, we wanted to talk about climate, but like, how do you talk about the thing that voters tell you over and over again they don't care about? After the election, I was taking some time off. Our first kid was being born, started looking at polling data, and I realized, like, oh, maybe the problem isn't a persuasion problem. Maybe it's a turnout problem. Maybe there are all these climate voters out there, and we just need to go and get them and starting to mobilize. You ask how things have changed? 8 years later, there was an open mayoral election in Boston. I was not involved. I was now running a nonpartisan nonprofit. The person who won, Michelle Wu, ran on a Green New Deal platform that was central to her entire campaign. And for anybody who's never been involved in local politics, let me tell you, like, you don't run for mayor talking about climate. You run for mayor talking about like public schools and potholes and things like that, because that's what voters care about in mayoral elections. But not in Boston anymore. It has changed. It's changed to the point that politicians feel comfortable running on that. And we're seeing the same stuff in our state and national data as well. There are more and more climate voters. Is it enough? To get to Wendy's point, no way. Not even close to being enough. We do not have enough power in the climate movement. Not even close. But we're getting more of it.
And I'll just add really quickly that made me think about this. It's a conversation I had with the Tamara, young woman who is here, and she is based out of Philly right now, and she was talking about how the Philadelphia mayor ran on a safer, cleaner, greener platform as well. And I also know that the Cleveland mayor, who is a younger black guy, ran on something similar. And so when we talk about how it has changed, to your point, seeing more mayors, particularly in urban areas, run on this platform in a way that we hadn't seen previously.
Yeah, taking off my ACC hat for a second, when I was a baby journalism student in Philadelphia in 2019, the Working Families Party was a really interesting story in the city council race, and part of their platform was essentially a Green New Deal for Philadelphia. So it is interesting seeing kind of those federal proposals, legislation, kind of trickle down into the local level.
Yeah, definitely a bottom-up, top-down. We all share, mix and mingle, like it all gets dirty and clean. Yeah, definitely, for sure. Well, I will go ahead and open it up to questions. I'll reiterate SEJ's Q&A policy. SEJ journalist members ask first. They get priority. Askers must identify themselves, state your name and affiliation when asking a question. No speeches, you guys. One ends with a period. The other one ends with a question mark. If it doesn't end with a question mark, I will cut you off.
Jennifer Mizrahi, Times of Israel, for Brittany. Brittany, you talked about Biden needs to up his game on grassroots. So I would love to hear your specific ideas, and particularly wanted to point out that the Senate race in Maryland, the Republican is 10 points ahead of both Democratic candidates. I'm looking at Ted Cruz is really in a tie, and I'm wondering if DEI plus abortion might make Florida in play for Biden.
You just talked about like six states, my guy.
Just, you know, grassroots. What do you think? What do you think would actually work?
Yeah, grassroots, I think, would actually work. I think having there is something about an invitation being extended to these folks who are in different states on the ground, one to the White House where that can be sponsored. But I think also going into communities, talking with the making sure that your state representatives and your congressional people are going back to their states, giving that information, talking to the state house, and then making sure that the state house gets it to the mayors, and then the mayors are trickling it all down. There's a mayoral convening that happens in D.C. every year. They should be talking about that and going back to their local places. I don't know if the Maryland question was for me or not, but I don't think it's surprising, being that we just had a turnover in the governor's race, in the governor's holding in Maryland, that that there could be, you know, the former
Hogan,
Larry Hogan. Yes, Larry Hogan. That's not surprising. And then just on my own whim, I don't think there's ever a play for Biden in Florida, and I think that DEI is. It's moving in Florida in a way that it is with very much intentionality.
I'm Clint Wilder. I write about the energy transition for Clean Edge. For Nathaniel, your numbers are very compelling and eye-opening in some cases. But what does Environmental Voter Project do to get those people off the couch? What works?
Yeah, so we work with now over 7,000 volunteers around the country to canvass, call, and send postcards to these voters. Then we as a staff also do digital ads and direct mail. As far as the messaging that we include in there, again, it's important to remember what our organizational goal is. We are not trying to get these people to care more about climate. Instead, it is purely turnout. And so because we're confident that these people, like, you shake them awake at night and they're going to scream climate change, we can be completely agnostic with our messaging. We could talk about chocolate chip cookies, if that's the best way to get them to vote. And what we have found, but I use we in the broadest sense, like what behavioral economists and behavioral psychologists and sociologists have found, is the best way to get people to change their behavior. So this is different from getting people to care more about climate, is usually treating them as social animals and not rational animals. You try to figure out what are the social norms that they buy into and how can you take advantage of that. So that's an answer at a theoretical level. At a practical level, what does that mean? Things like peer pressure. We'll say, hey, Ximena, did you know last time there was an election, 127 people on your block of Main Street turned out to vote? Peer pressure works. It's juvenile, but it works. Another social norm that people buy into is most people want to be thought of as honest, trustworthy people. So what do door-to-door canvassers often do? They get people, they ask people, are you going to vote or not? And the interesting thing is, even if you are an awful voter, you'll probably say, oh yeah, of course I'm going to vote. And that's like a trap being closed on you. Because then what we can do is right before the election, call you up and say, hey, I just wanted to remind you, you know, back in April you said that you were going to vote. Tuesday is the election, and that's your opportunity to follow through on your promise, and we know it's important to you to be an honest person. And now, yeah, it's a little aggressive, but, you know, so is the climate crisis, guys. And so now, instead of us trying to, like, rationally convince someone of the value of their one vote over a denominator of millions, we're equating the act of voting with whether they're an honest person who keeps their promises or not. And this stuff is so much more powerful in getting them to change their behavior. But again, I want to be very clear. This is a very unique and different type of messaging. If you're trying to get people to care more about climate, or if you're trying to get people to support candidate X over candidate Y, you would use very different techniques.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, I'm Madeline Heim. I'm with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Milwaukee's hosting the Republican National Convention this year, and I'm just wondering if any of you have thoughts on how to make sure to incorporate climate and environment coverage into our convention coverage.
First of all, I'll be there, so you could talk to me. Can't wait to see you there. No, but I think young conservatives are really the angle there, and kind of this next generation of the movement, and what they prioritize. I think the debate was a good preview of, you know, what ACC, but other conservative environmental groups will be doing there.
I also think that there are Republicans who care about these issues. I wouldn't ask them about climate, but I would ask them about clean energy or, you know, for people who are from Wisconsin. I mean, everybody, you all love your lakes. And, you know, we have broad bipartisan support in Wisconsin for protecting lakes because people know them. They have one, you know, down next to their farm. So I also think you could look at the Inflation Reduction, I'm back to the Inflation Reduction Act again. You could look at the provisions and see some of those are really good for rural areas, which will, you know, tend to be people who are attending the, you know, are going to be Republican, maybe attending the convention. So I think it would be really fun to think about what are some other angles. I think the young conservatives angle is awesome, but I bet there's other ones that would be interesting to find somebody who's coming to the convention and report on that.
You're already there. You can ask
okay,
it.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Helena Solomon. I'm the science reporter at the Amsterdam News in New York. And all of you, like, a lot of surveys and data and insights on people have come out of the conversation that you all raised. And it got me thinking about the questions you're asking people, especially whether it's trying to get more people to vote or engaging them on the issues that are impacting them. We're all people who ask questions for a living. I'm curious about the questions you ask and the things that you find get people talking about what affects them most.
Well, I mean, for one, we always start with put ourselves in their shoes. I mean, so we canvass a lot of doors. We just go to people's doors and we say, hi, I'm here from Environment California. And when we think about what we're going to say at that door, we're thinking this is a person who wasn't thinking about politics. They weren't thinking about the environment. They weren't thinking about saving the bees or saving the climate or renewable energy before I, you know, said hello. So you have to put yourself in their shoes. And so we find just asking about what they care about. How do they think about it? And using words that they would use. So no science, parts per million, parts per billion. We're not doing any of that. We're talking about their kids and clean air and, concepts that somebody can grasp quickly because they're just not living in our world like many of us live in.
Yeah, and I think something that we ask a lot of kind of members as they're entering ACC is like what their why is. And we found that a lot of young conservatives grew up hunting and fishing. They grew up on a farm. And there's a lot of different reasons to care about the environment and ultimately climate than, maybe what we think of like, oh, there's a hurricane or like, or I'm concerned about the parts per million in the atmosphere. There's kind of like a localized connection and why people get engaged with the issue.
Brittany, do you have an answer for that? Since you're
I was thinking like, who am I asking? That would Who am I asking that?
It's a very good question, back.
I guess like you mentioned, you're organizers, right? That are in local communities trying to educate people on the IRA and things like that. What are they asking people?
I think they are asking people, we lead with race. We lead with marginalization. So we lead with, if you're collecting data or if you're polling, do you have a wide representation of folks that you are polling that is not only racially diverse, but also there's diversity in socioeconomic status and education, in economic, salary range, and those types of things? I think your why is something else that we ask that matters. Does whatever you're doing move us forward in a positive way? Thank you.
Thanks for doing this. My name is Jake Biddle. I'm a reporter for the environmental magazine Grist. My question is for Carly. I'm curious what you see as like the potential limits of the overlap between, conservatism and conservation and climate change. Like, I totally hear what you're saying about clean air and clean water being a potential sort of way of presenting these issues, but it's also easy to imagine issues like carbon pricing or substantial reparative funding overseas that major parts of the Republican coalition would probably never support. So I wonder, like chamber, et cetera. Like, I wonder, at what point do you say, okay, we keep pushing on elected representatives to change their policies? At what point do you say, okay, we start ticket splitting? Like, what do you do in that sort of phrase?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think when we're looking at our approach, it's just completely different than perhaps a more progressive approach to these issues. It's not entirely focused on government action. There's a lot of elements to our work that are engaging industry or engaging other nonprofits that are doing work on the ground on climate or clean energy. So I understand your point about kind of the limits, and I think that when you're looking through a conservative lens on environmental policy, there are limits on what will be supported on a federal level, but there's a lot of opportunity in the private sector on the local level that we just don't talk about as much in kind of the overall conversation that conservatives are really engaged with.
Thanks.
Hi, Kat Murphy. I'm an undergrad from Quinnipiac University and an incoming investigative journalism fellow at the University of Maryland. I have another question for you. When Biden was elected, he was very much seen as the more moderate candidate among Democrats, but his policy platform as president has been relatively progressive. How are groups like yours planning to convince climate-sensitive conservative voters that that's a worthy trade-off?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll say in 2020, our 501c4 that can engage in political activity did not endorse President Trump, and it's unlikely we'll endorse him in 2024. So I think we're really more focused about kind of building a movement and looking, I hate to say it, but beyond 2024 and what this movement can do electorally beyond that. I will say ACC Action is really focused on Utah, where John Curtis is running for Senate. So we see, opportunity down the ballot to really raise up conservatives who are willing to engage on this issue. But, I mean, the Trump question, we could have a whole other panel about it, and I don't really want to get into it, but I think that there's a lot of opportunity down the ballot and looking forward to the future.
My name is Claire Carlson. I work for the Daily Yonder, and I wanted to ask about rural and urban voting behavior and if you've noticed any difference in environmental interest or concern based on where people live.
Absolutely. So first I'll say there is, even before you get into climate environmental issues, there is an urban versus rural divide just on the basic sort of political spectrum, right? Urban areas are more progressive, rural areas more conservative. That being said, among people who care deeply about climate and the environment, that division is even more stark. However, there are two points that I think are important to bring up, even with that baseline understanding. One, it varies from state to state. So for instance, in Georgia, I'm just guessing here, maybe 90% of our targets are within 10 miles of Atlanta. It's a very urbanized concentration of the people who care deeply about climate and the environment. Whereas in Pennsylvania, there is a shockingly large number of people who live in exurban and rural communities who care deeply about climate and the environment. Now, part of that's because Pennsylvania is Philly, Pittsburgh, and as James Carville said, Alabama in between. It's a very rural state in many places. But the second point that I want to bring up is, as all of you know because you report on it on a regular basis, the impacts of the climate crisis and the impacts of the many environmental crises hit people in different ways depending on where they live. Are they next to a stream that has been poisoned? Are they sucking in toxic air? Do they live next to, you know, likely wildfires or next to the ocean, things like that? And that will dramatically change which communities care deeply about climate and the environment. And I know that the Annenberg Public Policy Center just came out with a poll that very clearly showed the direct correlation between people's lived experience with the climate crisis, and surprise, surprise, they're then more likely to prioritize it as an issue. And Pew Research has that as well. And so, yes, this is a very urban constituency, but there's a lot of really interesting nuance below that.
Hi, I'm Madeline Ostrander. I am a freelance journalist, and I'm also currently a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT. I was just thinking as you were answering a previous question from one of my colleagues about how so many of the solutions that now sound like they're, you know, belong on the left are actually have a long history of conservative support, like market-based solutions for environmental issues, cap and trade, other kinds of solutions. There's also a long history of support for conservation on the right. And I wonder if any of that history or, you know, any of that kind of a legacy is useful in thinking now about how to reach out, especially to conservative voters.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the conservative legacy, perhaps most famously of Teddy Roosevelt, is really helpful in a lot of our work. But even thinking more recently, I mean, the EPA was created by Nixon. You have H.W. Bush signing really impactful amendments to the Clean Air Act. Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich did a climate change commercial together. So there is a legacy of that. And I think that kind of harkening back to a more bipartisan time in the environmental movement is helpful. And then also clarifying, you know, where we go from here and how we use that legacy is important.
Another good example of something that has been done by the Biden administration that I think fits well in the I love the conservation conservatives because it is crazy. I mean, those things have the same root. But all of the efficiency standards, which I know aren't that sexy or maybe that, you know, maybe they don't seem that interesting, but the Biden administration recently passed a policy around dishwashers and washing machines, which will increase the efficiency. And it's basically you kind of don't see it, right? Because you just go now to Best Buy and that's the kind of machine you can buy. Or you can see, oh, this one will cost me less to operate over time. I will use less energy, so it will cost me less. And the regulation that they passed will save households $2.2 billion with a B. So, again, I just think there are a lot of policies that you don't have to ever mention the word climate, but, in fact, are going to help us work towards solving the climate crisis, and I think fit well into, at least, you know, my parents were Depression-era kids, and so they had a very conservative outlook. So efficiency standards, they totally got, even my Republican father.
And I'll say the other part there is, like, energy innovation is an automatic winner with conservatives. I think the idea of, like, making energy more efficient, more reliable, more affordable, that's a really easy win. And the last thing I'll say here is I think sometimes bipartisan legislation doesn't quite get the coverage it deserves. I'm sorry, I know it's not the crowd to say that. But I do think that there's a lot more happening in a bipartisan manner than perhaps gets kind of the national attention that kind of the more partisan, polarized action does.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all. My name is Marissa, and I'm a reporter for WABE, Atlanta's NPR member station. And as we have vaguely alluded to kind of throughout the talk, Georgia has kind of become this epicenter of the EV/green technology boom in recent years. And that is something that a lot of our Republican leadership is really fans of slash hawk really often, despite the fact that they tend to be rather quieter, perhaps agnostic on a lot of other environmental issues, such as how the permitting situations for a lot of these industries tend to place the burden on our communities of color and lower income communities throughout the state. That being said, it's this really interesting dichotomy between propping up our successful EV businesses and also not talking about the climate side of it as much. This is often sold as jobs. And so I'm curious, how do you see this green technology and EV boom in more conservative states being pitched to voters and being pitched to those leaders' constituents? And if this kind of strange dual nature is something that you see in other states as well?
I mean, I think we're definitely seeing it. And I think it's the reason why I keep harping on the, you know, talk about what's in the Inflation Reduction Act, because it's benefiting just, you know, there are benefits to almost every community in America, and they're going to be different in different places. And I was talking to somebody last night who I can't remember, from Politico, about the fact that there's no place you can go and look by congressional district as to where where the money is being spent. So I'm hoping somebody takes on that project. Because I think we're just going to see more and more of that. And that will be, you know, we're seeing a shift in the way people think about clean energy, and because they're seeing there's, you know, in innovation, there's jobs and money to be made, and they're seeing it as, you know, something that they can get invested in. So I do think that will shift it. I mean, as it's just like the more people that drive electric cars, the more people who are going to be excited about electric technology and be interested in, well, wait a second, what about charging stations? Now that I have my Tesla, where do I charge it? Oh, there's money in the Inflation Reduction Act to put out more charge. Well, we should get some. Where are we getting that money? And you suddenly have people who are part of it, even though some of them probably won't. You know, they may still say they hate Joe Biden, but they're going to be excited about the money coming to do things in their own community.
It was one of the most politically shrewd parts of the Inflation Reduction Act that it created its own political constituency. Mm. Similar to, say, the Affordable Care Act did. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to take away that health care from all those 18 to 24-year-olds now? Or going even further back, like Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, the fact that these jobs are now baked into a community, and these are the people you see at the grocery store, and okay, like are we gonna shut down that factory now that it's built? It's almost unavoidable. Like it has to be a selling point of it. It is the most in-your-face aspect of the policy, and I think it was a very politically shrewd way to approach it.
Biofuel tax credits in the Midwest had that same effect too. Like I stood outside former Speaker Kevin McCarthy's office when a series of House members from the Midwest, looking at like Ernst Feenstra, all of them, went in to stop him from removing the biofuel tax credits during debt limit negotiations. In as a pack, out as a pack, in as a pack, out as a pack. And he didn't repeal it because it would have
affected people in their communities, and those were Republicans.
The other example, you talked about Georgia as kind of an example of where this is happening. Wyoming is pretty interesting, with a Republican governor kind of engaging on climate, but not necessarily saying climate. So Governor Gordon is a good example there, too.
Thank you all.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Gary Gardner, and I'm from the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy. Thank you for a great panel this afternoon. As you know, in Europe, many people are very concerned about the whole question of growth and the relationship between growth and climate and other environmental issues. I'm just wondering what you're seeing around the United States in terms of any interest in degrowth, any interest in steady state economies, that kind of thing, as kind of a direct and really rather inexpensive way of addressing climate issues. Are you seeing any of that in any of your work?
I mean, our organization is super interested in it. I mean, and we know we could have a whole panel. I would love to have a whole panel on this whole concept of kind of going back to the, you know, the fact that we're in a period where things are no longer scarce, right? I mean, we're living in an age of abundance. Not that everybody has everything. It's not exactly distributed exactly correctly, but we have so much. And stuff itself is the cause of many of our problems. I mean, climate change, top of the list, but also our pollution in communities and, you know, plastics in the water that we're drinking and the fish are eating. I mean, it kind of like stuff is sort of at the core of almost all of our problems. Mm-hmm. And we really still, the dominant paradigm that we're in is still growth is good. And we're going to have to address that head on. But that's a big project.
Are you seeing any of this at the grassroots level?
Yeah. I mean, when you start looking for it, there's lots of people write. I mean, it's more writing. I find maybe some of you have written. You know, there's like more journal articles and books. And, you know, there actually is quite a lot of thinking about it, but there's not a lot of activity on it.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd love to talk more about it.
I'll just say, from a conservative perspective, I think the idea that acting on climate means taking things away is going to be a difficult message to sell. So I'm not saying there's not some common ground there of, like, you know, I'm sure we can talk about kind of overconsumption or something like that, but this idea that we need to grow less, I think, is a non-starter with conservatives. So I'll contribute the one little disagreement to this panel.
Thank you.
And last question.
Hi, my name is Kayla. I report for the Great Lakes Echo in East Lansing, Michigan. And so Michigan is in the middle of a clean energy transition at this moment. And so a lot of this transition is going to have implications in our rural communities. And so, Carly, I'm especially curious for you, if you work within communities like rural communities like this, to kind of bridge those gaps between these climate solutions and innovations that are happening that are impacting people who live in rural communities, first and foremost with property type stuff and industry changes.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I want to thank the reporter from the Daily Yonder here, actually, because we exclusively released our rural polling there earlier this year. And as someone from a town without a red light, it's something very personal to me. But I think that perhaps we underestimate how much rural people care about this issue and how much they're willing to be involved in solutions. We found that more than 70% of young rural conservatives wanted a clean energy transition and wanted to be part of it. I think a lot of the kind of justification for it might be energy security or jobs. It might not be 100% emissions reductions, but I think kind of talking about the co-benefits of what a clean energy transition could do for communities is really important. For instance, you know, my dad might not care as much about emissions, but if he hears about jobs in our small community, that could be a really compelling message for him. So I just think it's about how we message it and how we talk about the co-benefits.
So I will ask the last question to the group here. You know, kind of thinking about the role that journalists play, like, you know, we've already told this group of probably very talented, already overworked people that they have so many other stories that they need to write, so many more numbers to look at, so much more data to crunch. Journalists are also going through a particularly rough time, and I feel like we say that
often. It's cycles, but we're in a rough one, particularly policy reporters and those who focus on issues that aren't sexy, like immediate politics or commentating. You know, kind of looking at how we are already in a beat that might be difficult to persuade our editors to write about, might be difficult to persuade us to keep our jobs. You know, what are resources that can kind of help make that number crunching easier? And, you know, what is that role for us here in an election year?
Candidates are going to compare themselves to each other. And over the next 7 months, many of you are going to be asked to write about politics, even though you're climate reporters. And one thing I would suggest is be a climate reporter. Don't try to be a political reporter, by which I mean none of the candidates are going to talk about the stakes. None of them are going to compare themselves and their policy agendas to what science demands, to what science says is necessary. That's not their job. Joe Biden's job and Donald Trump's job is to get 50% plus one of the vote on a Tuesday in November. They're going to compare themselves to each other. I think one really important thing is maybe don't go searching for some new font of knowledge. Instead, bring the font of knowledge that you already have to this new arena, because I promise you, no one in the political campaigns is going to say, oh, well, you know, let's talk about how our agenda stacks up to what physics says we need to do. No one's going to be doing that. And that is a context that is really, really needed for millions of readers and voters.
Yeah, this is kind of more in the, like, tips line, I guess. But one way to, if you're thinking about the horse race story, which is kind of what most of the stuff ends up being, is to take a step back and think about these different buckets of voters and think, okay, like, if I was a swing voter in X state, X district, what am I thinking about? And look at the candidates from that perspective. Similarly, youth, you know, young people, and I mean, many of you already do this, so it kind of feels stupid giving you advice, but I mean, that is, I think that's a useful way to think about it, that there are these different types of voters out there, not there, and even the buckets, of course, are all mixed up. It's not like a voter in the occasional voter bucket is just like every other voter in there, but I think thinking about it that way might help to kind of see it in a different light, and it doesn't require necessarily writing a whole new report and spending weeks, you know, analyzing data.
I'll add intersectionality, intersectionality, intersectionality. I know I've said that a lot of times, but I think that that is going to be very key for your reporting and to show the many connections, as my colleagues on stage have said, to climate, that it's that climate is a reproductive issue, climate is a transportation issue, climate is a housing issue, climate is a finance issue, it's a banking issue. There's so many layers of issues that this interconnects with that you as a climate reporter, environmental reporter, science reporter can weave in these different angles to tell a broader story to make it more relevant. I'll also add to diversify your sources. Stop going back to the same people and the same organizations that are your go-tos and have been on the record with you 1,000,000,000 times. Like, who else is doing this work? Do that research. And lastly, I would just add, like, go to the source. There is something that is very beneficial about going to your town hall, going to your school meetings and bringing it up if you're a parent, going to, you know, very localized places to see how they're talking about this and how there may be a story within that as well.
Yeah, and I'll just close this out. I think conservatives and climate reporters have not always gotten along, but I think we should be friends. So that's kind of my plea ahead of this election. And I think we have a lot of really compelling stories among our youth membership. Whether you're a national reporter or a localized reporter, I can probably connect you to an ACC member who's doing work in their community that's effective and impactful. So, yeah, that's just kind of my one ask is, to give us a chance.
I think there are, like, some pretty major takeaways here. You know, the elections are by and large not going to be decided on climate. But when you look at your local level, maybe they could be. That is where it is the most salient. And for voters, it's a pocketbook issue. And I think we need to stop siloing ourselves out as reporters and really see climate as the pocketbook issue. I mean, how many different things did we just talk about here? Looking at reproductive health, looking at other facets of healthcare, of education, you know, of the urban-rural divide. I mean, those are all things that, at the end of the day, are going to be seen as pocketbook issues, and that's definitely worth the advocacy and the space, I think, for our journalism. So thank you all so much for being here. I think we have some closing remarks, and of course, a round of applause for my panelists.
And for the moderator, yes.